Now, David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons. And the man was old, advanced in years, in the days of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him, Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest. And the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. Then Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp, and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000, and see how your brothers fare, and bring back news of them." Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. Then, as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Now, Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" Then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones did. My thoughts are not your thoughts. Neither are my ways your ways, saith the Lord. We've all heard that verse before, I trust, but see it here proven today in this passage before us. In this passage, the living God, who has been publicly defied for 40 days straight, he finally intervenes, and that's always good news for the people of God. However, and this is a big however, God's intervention in troublesome times does not always appear as we might expect, or maybe as we might hope that it would appear. Sometimes, to quote the classic hymn, God moves in a mysterious way. And that essentially is the main point of the passage. God moves in a mysterious way. And it's important that we learn that, because if we don't learn that, we'll end up feeling just like the armies of the living God felt on this day. They were dismayed, greatly afraid, crippled with fear. They were so focused on outward appearances that they could not see the hand of their God moving in this world or moving in their lives. It's the great theological tragedy of 1 Samuel chapter 17. So let's work through the passage together and see if we can't perhaps learn to recognize God's good working, God's glorious intervention. My first point today is this: God's intervention needed. God's intervention needed desperately. In order to convince the reader, that is you and me, of how desperately we need God's intervention, look at verses 20 to 21. They show us what the typical day in the life of one of Saul's soldiers looked like, describing how this army was going out to fight and shouting for the battle because Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. So it's obvious what happened every single day. You woke up. You're a member of this army. You ate your breakfast. You got your armor on. You grabbed your weapon. You marched out to the battlefield. And then they drew near to the front line, and I guess we know what happened. They saw the ranks of the Philistine army. And they shouted. They tried to stir one another up and tried to encourage one another. The battle is the Lord's, they probably cried. And who knows, maybe even they expected God to intervene one of those mornings. Remember, shouting did bring the walls of Jericho to the ground not so long ago. So they came out, they marched forth, they shouted. So far, so good. That's what soldiers are supposed to do. But here's the problem. They never got to fighting. They went through this whole routine for 40 days straight, morning and evening, never drawing their swords. And we know why. Verse 16 reminds us. The Philistine drew near and presented himself for 40 days, morning and evening. Verse 23 adds that he spoke according to the same words each of those 40 days. So here's the inglorious and humiliating conclusion. Verses 24 to 25, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him. They ran away. They were dreadfully afraid. And they even said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? He has surely come to defy the armies of Israel." Have you seen the man who has come up? Where had they been for the last 40 days? I mean, I could understand this reaction. Did you see that man on day one? But here we are, a month later, the man has come forth and presented himself and said the same old thing, 40 days straight, morning and evening. So what are they doing here? They're not wondering, have you seen this man? They're failing, and they're failing miserably. Now, we shouldn't be too quick to condemn them, because Jesus told us why. Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. That's what's going on here. I'd like to think, given the benefit of the doubt, they woke up each morning ready to fight. Ready to fight, encouraged, filled with zeal for the Lord. They marched forth with the same attitude, ready to fight. But just as the battle was about to begin, they changed their mind and they decided that retreat was the best option. Now we know from last week's passage and sermon, that's what happened on day one of this standoff. But here we're reminded that it got worse day by day by day. And here's the lesson, at least as I see it, from my own experience also. Long, drawn out, tedious, endless, seemingly endless battles can wear even the best of us down. It's called attrition for those who like military tactics. It's one of our enemy's favorite tactics. Wear them down. Or think of it this way, maybe you know this to be true, after 40 consecutive failures in life, actually we could double it because it happened morning and evening, after 80 consecutive failures in the exact same challenge, it makes you kind of dread the dawning of day 41. Worse than that, we're looking at the spiritual exhaustion of God's people here, but it gets even worse. Worse than them being sapped of all energy and faith, it only emboldens the enemy. It says that Goliath spoke the same words every one of these 40 days, but I imagine that his tone got worse and worse and worse day after day after day. So what we see in this passage is one of those classic 40-day trials, 40-day periods of testing. And what it teaches us, and maybe what it tests us with, is this: how desperately we need an intervening God, a God who intervenes from heaven. Because I know our spirits are willing, but our flesh is weak, and it becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. So here's the good news. Your God, Christian, does intervene. He intervenes. He does not lead his people to the front line of a battle and then abandon them. No, he gives them what they need. He is with them always, even to the end of the age. Your God intervenes. But here's the question. What does that look like, practically speaking? Let's move on to that in my next point. Point number two, God's intervention introduced or announced. The almighty hand of God is moving in this passage. It's the whole point of these verses. But his intervention is introduced here, well, in a strange manner, certainly in a manner that we might not expect. Most of us love the Old Testament. I love the Old Testament. So what we might expect to see is maybe some thunderings and lightnings like there was at Mount Sinai, or maybe some fire falling down out of heaven like there was at Mount Carmel, or at very least a thus saith the Lord of some wilderness prophet. But God's intervention here is introduced in such a quiet way. It's almost as quiet as that silent night and holy night on which David's son and David's Lord was born. Divine intervention. See it introduced in verses 12 to 14 by way of genealogy. David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had eight sons. The man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul. The three oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. Names of his three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. Genealogies. Some people don't like them. Those who do like them acknowledge them usually only as background information. But I want to remind you today they're much more than that. Old Testament genealogies are gospel. They are pure gospel. Remember, the gospel given at the beginning in Genesis 3:15, the gospel given was this: a child is coming. God was going to send a child to crush the head of a serpent. And we know the big question. We've probably heard it at home more than once. Mommy, where do children come from? Where do babies come from? Scriptural answer: they come from genealogies. And that's why genealogies are recorded in Scripture, to keep the hope of God's people alive. We have to think historically here. Since that promise, that first gospel was spoken in Genesis 3:15, the people of God had been looking and waiting and praying and hoping for this child to be born. And thinking historically, after millions of potential deliverers were born, and maybe after predicting hundreds of them, well, this is him, this is him, this is him. No, remember Saul? Hope can be diminished. So God, in his goodness, keeps giving genealogies to keep God's people hoping and believing. He even, as Scripture progresses through history, narrows things down so his people know where to watch. Examples, at the end of Genesis, talked about the beginning, at the end of Genesis, chapter 49, God told his people to be watching the tribe of Judah. Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be on the necks of your enemies. Watch for Judah. And then we all know the book of Ruth. The whole point of the book of Ruth is to get his people watching the city of Bethlehem. And that's where all these things begin to come together and lead us up to a passage like we've read today. Now, David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, of Judah. So no thunder, no lightning, no fire out of heaven, not even a thus saith the Lord, just another holy child born to believing parents. Just ordinary, everyday kind of stuff. So, stop and apply. Thanks for the history lesson, Pastor. Here's the application. This ordinary kind of stuff, the stuff of genealogies, is how God ordinarily works. This is how God ordinarily accomplishes his purposes. This is how God ordinarily moves history along. This is how God ordinarily defeats his enemies. This is how God ordinarily establishes his glorious kingdom. Guess what? The word ordinarily is very important to us Presbyterians. And I grant, God does send thunder and lightning and fire out of heaven on occasion, but it's only and evermore on occasion. The ordinary means of our God are just that, ordinary. Or you can think of it this way, back in 1 Samuel chapter 17. The actual felling of Goliath, the part that we all like so much, what, it took probably 30 seconds? Maybe 60 seconds if you count the decapitation at the end? But God's work of divine intervention took years. David conceived. David born. David receiving the sign of the covenant. David catechized, according to Deuteronomy chapter 6. David tested out in the fields, watching his father's flock. It's just, what would you call it? Ordinary covenant living. It's the ordinariness of biblical religion. But don't underestimate it. It is God working quietly, powerfully, through his most wise and holy providence. So that, back to the text, when the time comes for the big finale of God's intervention, the time for Goliath to fall and have his head lopped off, when it comes time for all of that, everything is already in place. And everything is just as it should be. Because that's how God works. It's called his providence. And I know we like that, the end of the whole matter, when things get interesting. So maybe we can turn to that now, away from genealogies. Thanks for bearing with it. To the next point, number 3. God's intervention described. Now we can look at the action. However, lest anybody get too excited too quickly, it has to be acknowledged that just as God's intervention was announced without a whole lot of drama in this passage, so also his action, it's described without a whole lot of drama. I mean, it begins, you might say, with a rather unexciting observation in verse 14. David, finally we hear about David. David was the youngest, still living at home, not even old enough to fight in the army. Nobody was paying attention to David, except maybe the sheep. We read of more non-excitement in verses 17 to 18. Jesse said to his son David, "Go kill the giant." No, that's not what we read. "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp. Carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000 and see how your brothers fare and bring back news of them." Here, the humble shepherd boy becomes an even humbler errand boy. And he does exactly what he's told to do. Verse 20, David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. So the errand is now complete, and things do get a little more exciting, because we could say David is now in position. David is where God needed him to be. Verse 22, David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, came and greeted his brothers. David is now in position, and for the careful reader, we might find a literary objection and say, well, if this is where we were getting, why all the running around? Why did it take so much time to get there? You know what it's called, brothers and sisters? At least we call it this in theology. It's called God's good providence. God's good providence, which sometimes involves a lot of running around. God's good providence is certainly hinted at in the genealogy, which reflects decades of preparation of God's working behind the scenes. But here, look, in God's providence, his ordering and directing of all things becomes all the more conspicuous. Now we can see David where he needed to be. But you know what? Even when God's providence doesn't seem conspicuous and obvious, it's still there. We need to realize God's providence is the one true, inescapable constant in the universe. God's hand at work. Church of the Living God, here's a burden. We need to regain a robust view of the providence of God. If we don't learn anything else from this passage, we need to learn that. The providence of God, God's hand at work behind the scenes, in the scenes, above, under, beneath, all of the time. Even such seemingly insignificant events as are mentioned in these verses. Take some grain and take some bread and take some cheese and ask your brothers how they're doing and bring back some proof that they're still alive. We need to understand that God's hand is at work in these events. But this is hard for us. That's why it's a burden. It's hard for us for several reasons, but maybe I could just mention a couple so that you can think about it at least. Scientism. Pride. Oh, they blind us to the good providence of God. Scientism, what's that? We know what it is. We think we've figured out how the scene works. We think we understand everything about the scene because of our science, and that blinds us to the hand of God working. Unrelated example I was reminded of it this morning. Gentle rain. There used to be a time when weather was interpreted as God's good providence. If the weather was fair and the gentle rains poured in the morning before the sun came out, as they did today, people thanked God for his good and kindly providence. On the other hand, if the weather threatened and tornadoes came, people feared God for his awful and intimidating providence. And now, today, what is it? It's just weather. We know how it works. Scientism. It blinds us to the good providence of God. You have to be aware of this and try to believe that God's hand truly is in everything. The other thing I mentioned was pride, and that's actually not unrelated. It's found right in this passage. Pride prevents us from seeing God's hand at work also. It makes us focus on the wrong things and look to the wrong things and draw wrong conclusions. It's made clear in this passage the hindrance of pride. David was the youngest. David was an errand boy. David was, therefore, the opposite of pride, and humility is easy to ignore. Let me make it sound a little more practical. We probably might all agree that the church of today, at least in North America, is in something of a sad estate. Certainly not what it used to be, not what it could be, not what it should be. We're all hoping, we're praying, we're working, we're waiting for a mysterious and surprising work of God in his church like days of old. We're hoping for revival, we're hoping for reformation. But here's a question to think about. Where do we expect to see it? Where do we watch? Where do we think we're going to see God's hand working? And it seems, at least to me, that people are always watching the biggest churches and the best preachers. Or to tie it to the passage, they're watching proud Eliab, the firstborn, rather than humble David, the youngest. This kind of thinking is just so wrong. I don't even know what else to call it. It's just wrong. It blinds us to the true working of God, that he doesn't choose the strongest and the mighty and the obvious, but he has chosen the base things of the world and the things that are despised, so that no flesh should glory in his presence. That's how God works, and pride blinds us to it. It gets us looking in the wrong direction. I mean, think of this passage. Nobody's expecting David to do anything here, except maybe what? Deliver some grain and some bread and some cheese, and then go back home to his father. It's the blinding influence of pride. Our admiration for big people. Our admiration for big mouths. It gets us looking in the wrong direction. Worse than that, not the happiest message today, sorry. It sometimes even causes us to miss God's hand altogether. We just miss God working because we're looking in the wrong place. That's what happens finally here. My last point for the sermon, number 4, God's intervention despised. Now, it's one thing to overlook the intervention of God, but God's intervention despised. 1 Samuel chapter 17 is a passage that drips with theological tragedies. We considered one last week. The people were focused only on outward appearances. That's why they were so filled with fear. They were crippled by fear because they were looking on the outward appearance of Goliath. They forgot who their God was. They forgot what their God had said. All they could see, all they could hear, all they could think about was the world's giant. Look, there he is, crippled by fear. That's a theological tragedy. In our passage for today, we see another. Even though God's hand was here working, even though God had just brought his champion onto the battlefield, everybody missed it. Nobody saw it. Worse than that, the church of the living God despised it. As David visited with his brothers on the battlefield, as usual, Goliath came forth, spewing forth his well-rehearsed Philistine propaganda. They had heard it before, and they hear it again. He defied the armies of the living God. Now, they had heard it before. They probably had his speech memorized by now. But here's a beautiful thing. David had not heard it before. David had probably never even heard anybody ever mock the living God. Think of it. He grew up in the Holy Land with holy people, growing up and living in a place where people kept the third commandment and they honored the name of God. Yet here he is on this day, seeing an actual giant and listening to the third commandment being broken loudly in public, and nobody's doing anything about it. Brothers and sisters, our consciences perhaps have been so dulled to such vulgarity and blasphemy that we can't even begin to understand the shock and the scandal that must have gripped David's heart on this day. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? He's reproaching God. David had some questions. He needed to figure out what was happening. So verse 26, spoke to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away this reproach from Israel?" And the soldiers tell him about all the great incentives. You would essentially become royalty if you went out and killed Goliath. But notice this, mark this well, brief aside but important one. Promises of health and wealth did not motivate the people of God. Promises of health and wealth do not motivate God's people to do anything worthy, because promises of health and wealth don't contradict the fact that somebody had to step forth and fight. Somebody had to risk life and limb. Somebody on one of these days had to decide that the honor of God is more important than my personal comfort. God's glory more important than me returning home to see my family after this month is over. The tragedy. We don't know how many people were arrayed for battle, but there was only one man on the battlefield that day. He wasn't even old enough to be a man. David. And he wants to know, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? After a 40-day stalemate, what a refreshing perspective. What a wonderfully simple evaluation of things. What a wonderfully biblical worldview. Finally, somebody who thinks clearly and sees clearly. Or you could put it this way. Never mind Goliath's monstrous stature, and never mind his glistening body armor, and never mind his lethal weaponry, never mind his thundering bravado. The real question is this: who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? That's what David wanted to know. That's a good response. It's a godly response. But we have to read the passage as it's written, which means we can't get too excited about it, because the passage is all about the intervention of God being despised. Look at verse 28, and we see it. Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, "Why did you come down here, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride, the insolence of your heart. you have come down to see the battle. Let me make this sound a little more New Testament-ish. Eliab had a beam in his eye called cowardice. He's the oldest. He's the soldier. He's the mighty man of war. And for 40 days, he allowed Goliath to blaspheme God because he was afraid. Yet, he so quickly here points out the speck in his little brother's eye, which he had probably done 1,000 times before. Big brothers are good at that, aren't they? He here charges his brother with sin, neglecting his duty, pride, insolence of heart, heaps accusation upon accusation. And this shouldn't sound too foreign because, oh, is this typical in the church? This kind of cowardice and censoriousness of spirit and speech. David, to no avail, tries to reason with him. What have I done now? Is there not cause? Well, of course there was, because his father told him to go there that day, and now there was cause all the more. Somebody is mocking the armies of the living God. Is there not a cause? Reasoning never works with cowards and hypocrites and bullies, though. So this is a tragedy, but as tragic as this is, this exchange between the brothers, here's the true tragedy of it all. The whole congregation of the Lord thought that Eliab was making more sense than David on that day. Look at verse 30. David turned from Eliab and asked somebody else, is there not a cause? These people answered David as the first ones did. You're proud, insolent, you came down to see the battle. Behold, yet another example of judging things according to their outward appearance. The passage does spend a lot of time on that principle because it's an important principle that we learn. So let me conclude the sermon by saying this. Judging things according to their outward appearance. That's what crippled the armies of the living God with such fear on that day because all they could see is Goliath. Judging things by their outward appearance. That also blinded the armies of the living God to God's good providence, God's true intervention on that day. For as they looked at David, all they could see, well, there's even a song about it that you sing in Sunday school. Only a boy named David, and only a little sling. Judging things by their outward appearance. Far better is it, beloved congregation, to acknowledge and to embrace the fact and operate according to the fact that our God moves. And our God moves in a mysterious way. Oh, may he convince us of that one biblical truth. Amen.